Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hey, listeners. This episode of the Battlestar Galactic cast may feature spoilers for events that come later on in the series. So be warned.
Be warned.
All ministers and officials should now go to Case Orange. Repeat. This is an official colonial government broadcast.
Hello and welcome to the Battlestar Galactica, as brought to you by Sci-Fi Wire. My name is Mark Bernardin.
And I am Trisha Hofer.
Hey, Trisha, how are you?
I'm in good spirits.
Yeah? What is this? Like, you know, it's either day 27 or 402. I can't be sure of quarantine.
It's somewhere in the middle there, yep. Somewhere in the middle. Up days and down days, but... Thankful to be healthy still. So,
indeed, I'm sequestered in my bedroom because my wife has commandeered the main space for school. So yes, I've now decided that this is my Howard Hughes studio, and I'm just never going to leave.
You can take a nap whenever you want.
I really can. I might just have to mute the video, so if I nod off, it won't be impolite.
Well, we got a fantastic episode to talk about today, right?
We do. I forgot the episode that it was until like midway through. I was like, is this? And then by the end, it's like, it is.
It is. Yes.
It is.
And I know we've, before we introduce our guests, what happened previously on Battlestar Galacticast? We talked about Dirty, ouch. Sorry, my foot just fell. Never mind.
Dirty, ouch.
Dirty, ouch. I'm sitting on a bar stool and my foot slipped off and slammed. Anyway, we were talking about dirty hands.
We had Aaron Douglas stopped by the Zoom room to talk to us about the unioniest union episode of Battlestar ever.
Yeah, it was a light episode for a lot of the regular cast, but a fantastic episode for Aaron Douglas. And brought him back to sort of his New Caprica roots and running. He sort of de facto got into it, but head of the union. So
yeah, like if there were any justice in the Emmys world, this would have been the Aaron Douglas Emmy nomination episode. This would have been the one they submitted. To be like, hey, this dude should get a nom. Here's, you know, the big cherry of the work of the season for him. Because the Emmys are stupid. That never happened.
Exactly. I'll go with you on that one. Yeah. But we have another character-heavy episode, and one that I think shocked a lot of people. So who better to have as guests than the gentleman that wrote it? We're going to be talking about Maelstrom, if I pronounce that correctly, with Bradley Thompson and David Weddle, who are returning. Hello, guys.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Oh, Bradley. That was perfect. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How are you guys holding up?
Well,
I'm not coughing up blood yet.
Excellent.
My wife and I lost a friend to coronavirus yesterday. So I watched the episode this morning and it's incredibly pertinent and to what's happening right now. So, yeah.
Wow. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah. Just, yes.
So, wow. You know, it's funny, like, well, I'll start the episode now. The previously on this episode, you know, I'm always amazed by how much heavy lifting the previous Leons can do, right? Because this is an episode that's very much about Kara, you know, Kara Thrace and her special destiny. And the previous Leon is like this history of Kara and Leoben. And it traces it back from the very beginning when, you know, we first meet Leoben and she has her sequences when she tortures him to try to get the truth. And he starts to get into her head. And then we're all the way up through New Caprica. And the fact that Kara has had a destiny and it's always been written is sort of the bookend of this episode. Here's how we remind people. Oh, by the way, she was also a victim of like parental abuse, physical abuse at the hands of a parent. Where did the idea, or how soon did the idea for this episode come up in the room? This idea that, you know, you would be looping in the entirety of Kara Thrace's history and bringing it to what feels like a conclusion of a source.
Well, David, I see. You were there for most of that. I think I was up during production at that point. And I seem to remember the original pitch was revised very soon after we tried to make it work.
Yeah. This episode is sort of the culmination of the organic writing process of Battlestar that was so profoundly powerful. No one person is responsible for what happened here. Ron Moore had from the very beginning this idea that Kara Thrace did have a destiny, that she would guide the human race to Earth eventually. He had that from, you know, almost from the outset of the series. So that was something that really is an idea that he came up with and pushed and promoted. So when we were writing the episode called well, first of all, Valley of Darkness, I don't know if I talked about this last time, Valley of Darkness, there's this scene that you just saw in the recap where Hilo and her go to her apartment and the mandala's there and she mentions that she painted it. Then she plays a song by her father. That was written by Ron Moore. That was a rewrite of a scene that we did. And it was just meant to be a character vignette. Here's two people at the end of the world. But Ron dropped these clues in, which he always does, not knowing what he's going to do with them. So then when we had to write Rapture, Ron said, when they go to the Temple of the Five, I want Kara to be able to see something on the temple, maybe writing that only she can read. And Brad and I then struggle with that a great deal. And what we learned to do on Battlestar is look at what's happened, draw from the past. So we hit upon the mandala. And we hit upon the idea that what if the mandala is something she's been drawing ever since she was a kid before it became that painting in Hilo's apartment? And maybe the mandala has a significance, predictive significance, symbolic of what her role is, evokes a whole bunch of things. So that's how that came into play. And then when we did this episode, it became central to the whole idea of her destiny that she doesn't completely understand, and it's tied in with the past with her mother.
Do you think she's always had a little bit, because throughout the series we've seen that, at least from the pilots that we know, that we've seen, she's always been the kind of more religious one or spiritual one.
Yeah,
she doesn't wear it on her sleeve, or so to speak, if that's the right expression, but she
fights against it. And here's the other part that Brad was asking me to talk about was, so we did that in Rapture. And then I'm up on the set for prep for Rapture. And Brad was already back in the writing room in LA because they needed him there. And Kate Sackhoff came up to me on the set and goes, so what is this destiny thing? And what is this mandala? And I said, well, we're still working on that, because it was always a fluid. We didn't have ready answers. And she said, well, I thought, what if the mandala is something it causes me to look at my past and recontextualize something that happened in my past that seemed not important, but now I realize is important. So I brought that back into the writing room, and it was embraced by Ron and everybody. And that's how we began to expand this whole idea of something in her past. And of course, then we went to her mother, which is something that Ron more established and put all the little stepping stones in the first, you know, 2.5 seasons that we then began to expand and explore here.
Now, so I'm Katie, remembering
also, asked that question, you know, really, really sort of brought it into focus. Go ahead, Brett.
I'm remembering also that the one of the pitches was, and whether it was David Icke or Ron or somebody, because again, I was up and didn't hear it, was that, well, the idea is we go way down and it looks like we're going to lose Kara Apollo have find something out about each other that they didn't know before. And we,
yeah, when I came back, yeah, when I came back, they were talking about Lee and Kara are on combat duty on Cap and they explore their relationship. That's all that was there. And then I said, well, here's what Katie Sackhoff said. And maybe we could add that element. And then as a room with Mark Verheiden leading the room, we came up with the idea of the clouds. I'm not sure where that exactly came from, but with the idea of her going down into the vortex. But we broke it that then she pulls out in the end. And she realizes from the psychodrama, she has some revelations. And it was Ron Moore who said, no, she dies. And we were all like silence in the room, writing room for a few minutes. And then we started to embrace that and saw how powerful that was. And of course that fit in with Ron's concept of the character from the outset of the series.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Like I got halfway through this episode and I was like, you know, if I didn't know better, this feels like a send-off episode for a member of the cast. Like I said that last week about Dirty Hands. It's like, if I didn't know better, Aaron, I would think they were going to kill you at the end of Dirty Hands. He's like, yeah, I know. There's a lot of meat on these bones. And then I got into this one. It's like, you know, if I didn't know better, I think they're going to kill Kara Thrace. And then you do.
One of the David mentioned the clouds, and part of the clouds was during the research. We were looking at planetary stuff and Jupiter and all of, and, you know, we'd originally done the Eye of Jupiter, the Eye of Zeus, which became, and we were looking at actually the physical way the atmosphere was set up. And it turns out the mandala and that atmosphere around Jupiter and stuff was perfect for the mandala. I mean, physically and scientifically, it could be there. Though whether Kara would be the only one to see it is kind of mystical. Mm.
That's actually something that my memory is that, Brad, you came up with a lot of that. And then what happened was we're on the set for pre-production, and Gary Hutzel, the great Gary Hutzel, came running over. He goes, I've previs on going down in the clouds. Here's what we're thinking of doing. And it was just the ecstasy of working on this show. He was so carried away with it. And then Michael Nankin went to the storyboard artist and drew, you know, every bit of that sequence and in started color. To expand it. So it was, you know, it was the whole team jumping in and starting to contribute facets, you know, to this.
I mean, you mentioned. Go ahead, Tricia. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say it was Michael Nankin that directed this episode, correct?
Yes, and he did such an amazing job with it. He got the emotions out of these two actresses in the scene we just saw. He brought a kind of hallucinatory power to the episode. And got such great moments with the actors. And watching again this morning, I was also struck by Ron Moore, who really, you know, in the post-production process, he loves moments between actors. And there's so many silences and characters just looking at each other. And all the emotion in the characters, the way that the episode's cut is also quite stunning. But Nankin, huge part of this. He was his idea, I believe, to see her young self in the washroom, in the cockpit. The going up to the cockpit, I think, was Ron's idea. She just freezes, but it was Nankin's idea to put her young self in the cockpit. He just added so many layers.
We had written this, and we were very proud of this. And then Michael Nankin looked at the script and said, "You know what? Because her mother originally was not in the show." We just referred to how horrible it was. And David, you were there for this, but I seem to remember something about a lion and.
Oh, you were there too. We We wrote it at first. The flashback, the first version of the flashbacks was Kara goes to see her mother who's had a stroke and she can't talk. It was all a monologue of Kara to her mother. And then a tear start to come out of her mother's eyes and she goes, stop crying or I'll give you something else to cry about. Remember that line? And yes. Then she runs out and we came in the writing room and Ron Moore said in front of all the writers, that's the best script you two have ever written for me. And, you know, that was a powerful moment. And then Michael Nacken comes on and he goes, I don't understand the relationship with her and her mother. I don't get it. I don't know why her mother was important. And we're in prep. We've already started prep. And Ron defended it for a while. And then he turned on us and he said, maybe Michael's right. Maybe we need to see the lion roar one more time. Maybe it's the day her mother gets the news that she has cancer and Kara arrives on that day. And we play out a whole scene in which we can see the spectrum of the relationship in that scene. What do you guys think? And like, I couldn't swallow. And I'm like, well, it all sounds great, but I don't know how we can do it in 3 days. I think we had 2 days, 3 days, whatever, to turn the draft around. And Michael Nacken laughed and says, oh, you guys can do it. You wrote Scar. And so Brad and I didn't sleep. I mean, we walked the entire Universal backlot. We tried to come up. We didn't hit on the mandala being in the scrapbook until that night. Ron told us a lot of things about his relationship with his father and mother, which paralleled things that Brad and I had experienced. And it all came together. I remember going into Ron's office like with like no sleep, my hair standing up. Look, what if the mandala's in the scrapbook? And what if her mother always had faith and it was, you know, trust the message, not the messenger? And he goes, that sounds great. Go ahead. And then we wrote it. And but it was because Michael Nacken pushed for it. And then Ron Moore embraced it.
Can I interrupt you for a second for something that just went by? When we're talking about fathers, we just did the thing about the rubber bugs and smashing their shoes, which came from your dad.
Yes, my dad had been this is really why it's such an important episode to me, is it's my father and me through with the genders reversed, Kara and her mother. The fight is almost exactly something happened 4 days before my father died. The rubber bugs, my dad fought in the South Pacific and he had post-traumatic stress and he had phobia about bugs and he was abusive like her mother, but also loving in strange, weird ways. So when I was a kid, I put rubber bugs all on his shoes in a closet. He came home from a trip and he's screaming, he's trying to smash the rubber bugs with his shoe and they're bouncing in the air. Yeah. So
there's
a lot of personal stuff like that in here.
Some of those phrases that mom says, I understand, come from your life.
Yes.
One of the more unpleasant ones. One of the beautiful things about working with Michael Nacken and in the writing process is working with these actors. I mean, probably we should talk about the Katie going in there and then Michael's direction of that, but what I'm getting at right now is we would write dialogue that was, it explained everything. It was beautiful. It was heartfelt. I mean, just to pat ourselves on the back. And then Michael would be sitting there on the set and he'd go, do we need this line? Because it's all over her face. What about this one? What about this one? And we end up chopping all that stuff out because the actors are delivering it without having to say it.
I think we talked about this once before. It might have been with you guys when you were online.
We did talk about it before.
Yeah, that sometimes, you know, when you're writing it, obviously it's on the page and you're putting it there. But then when you're actually seeing it, sometimes it's stronger not to have everything particularly, you know, spelled out or whatever.
And actually, it's an organic process. You know, we've sort of operated ever since like that. You have to put the dialogue in at first, one, for the network, so they understand what the character draws, and they ask for that, but also for the actors. And then once everybody understands the underpinnings and the emotions, then you can begin to do what Brad was saying Nacken did and we did. You can start pulling lines out because everybody knows what the drama is now, and now it can play on their face, and you don't need all the dialogue that you thought you needed. So, yes.
That also happens in editing when you're sitting along and going along going, do we actually need this? Because look at that, you know?
I, you know, in addition to Nick, and of course, this is a Katie Sackhoff episode, and I just got to say what an absolutely phenomenal actress she was. And also, Jamie Bamber is so good in this. His love for her, his support, even when he's not, he's so powerful when he's not saying anything, just looking at her. But Katie, like Michael, what he did was so great in the scenes with the mother that are coming up. She would open her guts out emotionally. And then Nick would go, let's do it again. Only want you to smile this time, do the whole thing. Try to see that it's happy through the set. And she would now do one, you're angry. It's more angry. And she did it, all of those. Never complained. Time after time after time. It was just, it was phenomenal. Phenomenal what she did.
And his directions were things like, okay, you told it for her last time. This time, tell it for you. Or this time, you told it for you last time. Tell it for her. You know, real subtle stuff. Trish, is that the kind of stuff that you responded to or you ran into with him?
Yeah, you know, I mean, we kept using the same, you know, by this point in season three, there was a number of directors that would just come back repeatedly, right? And they were all, that was for a reason, because they were invested, but also, you know, they could relate to the actors and to the writers and everybody, right? It becomes a team. So if somebody doesn't fit in with the team, they end up not, you know, working. They may be a great director, it's just not for that project or something. But I personally, I love specific notes. I love, and it's something like that, even if it's tell it for her instead of tell it for you, that says so much without having to over explain it. Or when it's told from if it's a technical thing about hitting, you know, something has to be seen in the shot, you know, you have to hold the gun up higher because of the framing or something like that. That's one thing. But if it's about the emotion and the character, yeah, subtle, simple, to the point directions. I love the play with the director when you get along and you can just understand each other. And there's sometimes, especially after you work together for quite a while, like I had this on Lucifer with Nathan Hope. He'd come in to tell me something and he'd say one thing and I would like, you automatically know what he's meaning and you just like, yep, got it. And I think that happens sometimes with Nankin too, or with Reimer or whatever. You can just, you're each other's language, you know, you understand each other's language, and that's when it's super fun, because you can just, you're playing. You're telling a story, but you're playing and you're trying to find all facets of it. And what ends up working best in the editing room is sometimes maybe a choice that you didn't necessarily expect on the day.
Right. And I think it wasn't like that Nankin didn't like what she did in the take. It's just like, let's see how many colors we can get so we can shape this in editing. Like, we might at this point want a different, slightly different color to the scene.
This was also something Ron would do in the writing is, you know, he'd go down different roads. You know, it's like, okay, I know what's there and I can come back to that if I need it, but let's see what else is out here in this material. Let's see if there's something better or more interesting or different. And speaking of playing around, I was just watching Aaron on this. He's one of those actors who you just start a scene and he'll come up with stuff. He'll just, you know, business and all these other things that you're not expecting. They're not written in there, but they're part of the character that he's built, like this guy on the deck chief.
Brad wrote this scene that's playing right now, and it's a wonderful scene of most of the emotions are beneath the surface as they try to grapple with do they pull Starbuck off combat duty or not?
Some of this came from actually the Battle of Britain and a book called Piece of Cake, where they were talking about a guy they were trying to take off combat missions because he kept quoting Churchill and he would fly upside down. You may remember Hot Dog doing that earlier. It was kind of, they were going, is he crazy? But by then in the Battle of Britain, just about everybody was. It just says, keep him away from the radio and keep him flying, you know?
Tell me a little bit, guys, about the line between the real and the fantastic on this show, because for much of the show, religion has been definitely a shot through every episode, every season. It's a kind of conversation between the, you know, faith and fact, or faith and science, or the objective versus the subjective. And this feels like it's one of the first episodes, if not the first episode, to come down pretty hard on, yeah, no, Kara goes to speak to this oracle, and this oracle knows things that there's no way this oracle could know. It's not part of the Pythian prophecies. It's not part of some text somewhere. She just knows things about Kara she shouldn't know. And then, you know, all the things that Kara sees and her experiences that nobody else seems to be able to corroborate. When did you guys decide that you were just going to kind of drop anchor into the mystical?
Well, before we jump into that, I'm watching this scene here where the kind of fits with what we were talking about earlier and our own situation right now, which is these are two people talking about where you want to be when you're dead, which kind of does get to the religion. You're saying, where does my picture go when I'm doomed?
And actually, we set this up. I think we talked about this last time, because the last time we did commentary was Scar. And the end of Scar was talking about, or in the middle of Scar, Cara Thrace confronts Kat and says, you're afraid you're going to end up like Riley's girlfriend, just some picture on the wall that nobody really remembers. And now we bring it back. We purposely brought it back here, which is, yes, what Brad's saying. It's about mortality. And what does it mean to die? And what is what do you leave behind? And so
and that's kind of what religion was developed to service. I mean, you've got that great big mystery. And, well, okay, maybe there's a God. And then you...
Michael Nankin came up with this, by the way, what you're seeing right here, the mandala material. He kept looking for the mandala to keep reappearing through the episode from Starbuck's point of view often. And it's just such a great, brilliant idea.
With the candle wax, yeah, that's...
But to answer your question about the spiritual, you know, the Bible of Battlestar, it started out like, oh, it's all going to be handheld camera. We never go in a point of view of a character. We never use slow motion. We don't, you know, it's all objective, like a camera crew's following them around. Ron Moore is the one himself is the one who started violating that way, like halfway through the season. And he brought all the spiritual stuff into it. Flesh and Bone, he did a rewrite of that. He brought in all the Leoben. I see the shadows. I see the things that happen before they happen, blah, 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 blah. And as a writing staff, we were baffled by that draft when it came in. And Rom didn't explain a lot of it about it. He just started putting more and more at the end of the first season that becomes, you know, Trish and going into the opera house with Baltar. That's the end of the first season, right? Am I correct?
I'm not remembering it that well.
I think at the end of the first season, they go in the opera house and they see the baby on the stage, the baby, the bassinet, and say, well, the shape of things, take a look at the shape of things. And then it starts to become this whole metaphysical thing starts happening. And Reimer really sold the hell out of that. So we just started building on that. Ron Moore really is the person that brought that into it. And yeah, then it's fundamentally important in this episode.
Well, this was also, Ron was brave enough to do, okay, I feel this strongly that this could lead somewhere, but he had no idea where it would lead. He was just trusting that impulse, which is kind of like, Trish, when you snap the neck of the baby. We had no idea where that was leading.
Yeah, and it almost didn't make it in there, right?
Yes. So I think, you know, and I personally, it's interesting for me because I'm basically an atheist or agnostic, but I don't consider myself not to be spiritual. I think that there's this reality that we live in is, you know, subjective at best, and there's forces we don't understand. And to me, I guess what Joseph Campbell or Carl Jung would say, they both love mandalas, by the way, as much as Grateful Dead did. It's the mystery. It's trying to find metaphors to explain the mystery of life and death, and which nobody has the specific answers to. So yes, the Oracle says things that, how does she know that? I think all of us probably have had experiences like that in life, things that happen that we can't explain. For myself, I don't come down to okay, that means there is a God and there is a place that's like the assisted living in the clouds where we're all going to go and la la la. I don't know the answers. But other people, that I can tell you in the writing room, there's a spectrum of responses. Brad has very different beliefs than me. There is equally valid, I think. So we tried to hint that we tried to lead the breadcrumbs that there's so much we don't understand about life and death and this existence and this gift we're given of consciousness. But we didn't want to come down with hardcore answers. So hopefully this episode has as many. I mean, I love the ending where she says, "You're not Leoben." And he says, "I never said I was." And yet we never answer, what does that mean? Who is he? And that's open for your we want the audience to argue and try to think for themselves, well, what was Leoben? Who is he? And what does this mean, dying and rebirth and all that?
Well, that there is so much of that in this episode. And also, I mean, you guys did that brilliantly, but also in the whole show is like, yes, it's leaving it. There are the black and white things. There are the answer, you know, the certain questions that or issues that you're like, that have a specific answer.
Yeah.
But there's so many that you do leave it open for the interpretation of the audience. And I think that's one of the reasons the show was so powerful is because it affected people in, and like you said, you two as writing partners have different beliefs, but that's okay and allowed, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, if you're, again, I'm just babbling but
you're not babbling at all.
It
brings in the two of us having different perspectives on, say, God, death, and what have you, allows us to give different characters different feelings about this. You know, I've got my take on the way the universe is constructed. Might be Kara's version of it, and David's might be Lee's. It might be flipped. It might be, or we might take pieces from one and another to create the beliefs that these folks have.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
I think that's important for a writer's room. I mean, all three of you are in writer's room. And Mark, do you find that as well, that a diverse writer's room in beliefs, in genders, races, everything like that, because they writer's rooms have not always been diverse necessarily. And do you find that that's always been like, it's 100% you need a diverse room in beliefs so that you can come up with different.
Yeah. I mean, plurality of opinion is vital and perspective is vital. Because you want to be able to have this swirling bouillabaisse of ideas and perspectives and subjective realities. And here's my belief and here's what I think about A, B, C, D, or E, to ultimately let your showrunner decide the kinds of instruments he wants in the symphony. And he can amplify this and he can call for that. And because the showrunner is a conductor, he gets to say, I want more like third bassoon in this, and I want a little more timpani here. But those instruments are people's experiences in the world. But ultimately, that showrunner is going to make the decision for what the perspective of the show is. And that was what I was curious about, you know, when I brought up that idea of faith, because the show does make a fundamental shift in how it perceives what faith is and its objective reality. In that previously it had been, you could argue that, you know, the Temple of the Five was, yes, built by previous people and might not have any metaphysical, metaphorical power at all. Or if you, like Galen Tyrrell, believe in the scriptures, this means everything. You know, it's, and much of the show had been that way, this sort of back and forth between the real and the believed. But this, for the first time, is like, no. This is magic in a way that the show had yet to quite be about magic. And that is in no way pejorative. It's just, I was struck by, oh, this, it's planting a flag that magic is real, which I found fascinating.
Yeah, I always saw Mark as metaphoric. So, but it is, you know, I had a copy of the Iliad and the Odyssey in my office at Battlestar. I was reading it during this time, and the Greek stories, myths, the battle of the siege of Troy and the journey home by Odysseus, the gods are always coming down and interfering and taking part in human drama. And it was so relevant to what we had here. And so for me, it's metaphoric. And like, I, yes, undeniably, there's like powerful things in this episode that would seem to indicate, yes, there are spirits, there is another dimension. And, but I don't know. To me, I see events like that a lot of time in life. We can probably all tell stories like that. But does that fundamentally mean I know what happens after you die? No, I don't think so. But other people would say that they do. So, yeah, but I understand what you're saying. It's very, it definitely goes into the metaphysical in a much deeper way. But I would say that had been a progression from the middle of the first season onward. We just went deeper and deeper into all this. And it's weird to me, being an atheist, how powerful it all ended up being for me and how much it meant.
Came from her, if I recall correctly.
I was struck. This entire scene that we're watching, I mean, we haven't at all talked about the drama of the episode, really. But, you know, here's a scene where we're back in Kara's apartment on Caprica. And I kept trying to figure out what she wrote on her wall. Mm-hmm. Where did that stuff come from? I'm like,
that's memory too. Yes. Katie
wrote all that stuff.
Yeah. And she painted a version of the mandala, or maybe that very version. That is also my memory.
I now that you guys bring it up, I do remember Katie like going in on a day off or something like that to, you know, obviously it had to be done prior, and just like going in and painting. I'm sure somebody was somebody with her? Was there art set direction with her, or did she just go in there and have loose?
I don't know the answer to that question, but it's so great. That's so great about this show is the organic. She paints a mandala on the wall. Ron writes a thing where she plays her father's music. None of that was, we didn't know where any of that was going. We didn't know if we'd ever revisit that. Brad and I, in desperation, because we need something on the Temple of Five, go back and watch the flashbacks not the flashbacks, but the scenes in Valley of Darkness, go make it the mandala, which Katie painted and came up with, right? So it's like this jazz band of creative forces. It's like the whole show, all the creative elements, you know, as a group mind.
Speaking,
I guess,
of creative elements, look what my kid's doing with these images. Steve McNutt, our DP for this show. I mean, look at these things. They're just gorgeous. And David mentioned Gary Hutzel and Mikey Gibson, you know, and you're watching these dogfights, which I'm doing now. We're both doing this now for All Mankind, and they are painfully difficult to pull off, and just the execution of this so long ago, and they still hold up.
You guys are working with Steve McNutt again on Roman, right?
Yes, we are.
Oh, there's your cat too. Our cats can wave at each other.
Yeah, this is Nick.
Oh, surrounded by cats, as always. But yeah, like I was trying to, it's like, all right, melodically smoking my cigarette, every breath I breathe, met the day with every delicious sip, I drink away the night, stroking my hair to the beat of his heart, watching me sleep. Like, oh, that's deep and weird and cool and apparently 100% Katie. So good for you, Katie.
Yes. This scene has a lot of elements of Ron Moore's childhood, my childhood, Brad's. We wrote, I wrote this sequence, and it was originally 7.5 pages long. And Harvey Fran, our great line producer, said it can't be 5.5. We'll never make the day. So I cut it down to like 5.5. And then Harvey's going, I still don't know that it's short enough. That we have an older actress. What if she doesn't, we haven't worked with her before. What if she doesn't know her lines? We could be in deep trouble. And I threw a total shit fit and said, okay, I'm going to gut it. I'll get it down. I'll get it down to 4 pages, but I'm going to ruin the scene. And so I'm in my office, like totally pissed off. And Brad, I think you were involved in some of the diplomacy of getting Harvey to talk to Nankin, and Nankin said, no, I go ahead.
Oh, it was, you had cut it down, and it was absolutely true that there was no point in doing it by the point when we were bringing it way down. And so you took that version to Michael Nankin, who said, you're right, this can't be shorter. And I don't remember what brought the two of them together, but I think we did negotiate and said, well,
my memory is you got Harvey to talk to Nankin. I'm in my office pissed off, butchering my own scene. And then all of a sudden Harvey shows up in my doorway and he goes, this is why Harvey was such a great line producer. He cared about story. He actually sent us a note when this episode came. You never get notes from the line producer. He goes, this is one of the best episodes, like that line producer would write that. Anyway, Harvey showed up in the doorway and I'm pissed. I go, yeah, what, Harvey? I think he's going to tell me I can take another page out. He goes, I talked to Nankin. He says he thinks we can make the 5.5 pages. Don't cut it. And so we didn't. And the irony upon it all is we did cut it into editing. It didn't have to be 5.5 pages. But having all that connective tissue and the moments between the actors is what makes what remains so good, in my opinion. So I do think it was worth fighting for. But ironically,
I mean, this scene is it's pivotal. Like, this is the moment that changes the trajectory of Kara Thrace's life.
Yeah.
Like, yes. If her mother had been able to look past her anger, you know, past her cancer, and just seen her daughter excelling, then yeah, Kara Thrace doesn't become the character who self-sabotages everything, who refuses every connection from every person she's ever met.
Yes.
You know, like, it's gotta.
This is the origin of her dysfunction, though we'll get another episode with her father later. But but the mother sees a truth about her. That's why you mistake the messenger for the message. And that's true of my father and Ron Moore's father. My father was incredibly abusive and tough, but he believed in me and thought I had talent and wouldn't let me quit writing. I wanted to quit so many times when I was an unsuccessful young writer. And he said, no, you're not going to quit. You have a talent. I'm telling you. And I didn't believe that Ron Moore's father felt that about him. And, So it's that weird, complex thing with a parent. You know, they're neither good nor bad, nor, you know, they're a combination of both. And Michael Nankin storyboarded all. I remember going with him on a weekend while he storyboarded this. And by the way, when we came in and did the scene, this actress, I forget her name, she knew she was letter perfect on her lines, better than Katie. And we never had a problem after that. So. And Katie wrote the occasion.
Oh, there's another piece to this story, which was literally that was a 5.5 page scene, but it was an 8 page day, and we'd never done more than 6, which was what was freaking Harvey out. And it was on location, and it turned out, and I don't run into this. I certainly didn't run into it elsewhere in my career. But it could have happened. But like the where we were shooting this, the trucks had to be off the streets by 1 a.m. You know, literally Vancouver wouldn't let you put film trucks on there after 1 a.m. We had like 6 pages by noon, but Michael was going for the gusto and trying to get the best emotional moments he could. So we're down there at the end of the day. And what the Teamsters had done was they had a method. They were working with us on this. It's like, okay, what we'll do is we will park our cars on the street and take the trucks off at the last minute and then come back for our cars. I mean, everybody tried real hard to make this happen. And we did it. I mean, literally down to the last
the whole team.
Yeah, Dorothy Lyman, who was on All My Children for a while. She was a soap actress for a bit.
Yes, Michael Nankin brought her in. He believed in her, and he was right. She did an incredible job. Thank you for looking that up, Mark.
She's fantastic.
With her since. I worked with her that one time, and it was quite an experience.
Yeah, I mean, she's got two scenes to just come in like a storm, pardon the pun, and she nails it. You totally understand that relationship between those two women.
Yeah. I had, my parents had died, just not quite 10 years before this, both of them. And so death was very much on my mind and confronting death. And it was certainly on my mind this morning watching it again. And this, I just love this scene. It's so beautifully shot. And the performance of Katie watching her younger self and her with Leoben, the actors are all to have such beautiful depth and dimension. And this is all Michael Nankin pulled this off. But when she has to go in the door, I remember that my dad was dying and I had to go in the room where my dad was dying and I didn't want to. I didn't think I could do it. And yet I did it. And I talked to Katie about that moment on the set here, and she just rose to the occasion so powerfully.
Yeah.
And my dad was like, you know, punishing and yet kept all my stories and was like my biggest, you know, fan. I would not be here on this podcast without him. And we wanted that duality in her mother. And then thinking about death, having lost a friend yesterday, this whole thing about crossing over the mystery of our lives ending and what happens. You know, Timothy Leary, before he died, he had terminal cancer, goes, "At last, the final adventure. I'm going to cross over. I can't wait." He wasn't going to kill himself, but like that, he had this attitude toward death like that. And I thought, my God, I wish I could have that attitude. I wish right now I could have that attitude. I try, but I'm not there. And
one of the things I'm watching in this scene is like she kept everything. And now that we're on the death kick, which of course is what a lot of this show is about, is the day that my dad died, he had my business card from Deep Space Nine in his wallet. He didn't have a long, long in bed thing. He just fell over one day. But that was very moving, that through all of life, he was still proud of that.
You never told me that. I never heard that story.
I'd forgotten it for a while and ran into it the other day. I had written it down.
So, you know, one of the things, this is one of the scenes that Michael had her do over and over again with different emotions. And then he brought in a little fan. This is how Michael Nankin thought. He brought in a little fan that I thought he found it. I might be remembering wrong, where he asked for a fan. And so when, you know, just before she crosses over and you see the wind blowing, there's just ideas like that Nankin had to elevate every moment and increase the dreamlike power of this thing way beyond what we conceived of writing the script.
Yeah, there's definitely like It's a Wonderful Life quality about mm-hmm. the sequence where, you know, she gets to see the ending that she never got to see and how that can change her life going forward and make her open to
the reconciliation that she did not have in life because she was afraid.
Yeah.
And with my parents dying, what I was struck about, it's horrifying and it's painful, it's wrenching, but there is a beauty to be there for your parents who brought you into this world and to be with them when they die. There's something profoundly beautiful about it amidst all the horror. And that's one of the things I love so much about the end of this episode that everybody captured.
I think that's one thing to bring it back into what we're all going through right now with this pandemic is I've heard so many times of exactly what you said, regardless what your relationship was necessarily, to be able to be there. So many people that are not being able to be there for their loved ones or their whatever because of, you know, the isolation. And it's got to be incredibly difficult for families and you know, sons and daughters and whatever, or parents, to know that your loved one is in the hospital, and you could go on a normal day. It's not like a, you know, an accident where you had no choice to be there or not. Knowing you could be there, but you're barred from being there has got to be really tough.
Yeah. When my mom was dying, my mentor and hero, Ken Kesey, said to me, she had a brain tumor, but she was in a home and I was seeing her every day. And he said, be thankful that you have the opportunity to grieve with your mother and to be there with her and to tell her how much you love her. A lot of people don't get that. And I guess, Trish, what you're saying, you know, the challenge for all of us now and for our friend who lost her husband yesterday, we have to find ways to claim that and not lose that, and some way to grieve that's meaningful to us and not let go of that. And that is a real challenge of what's happening right now.
I mean, and in both, you know, ways that are horrible, events that are horrible and joyous. Like my brother's wife had a baby yesterday,
right,
and he couldn't be in the hospital with her. Like he couldn't be by her side.
Right.
He was basically having a baby in 1953, where he was like, you know, waiting at home to get word. We had a boy, we had a girl, you know, and it's like lovely and wonderful, but he's now losing that moment of that experience that you should, in a perfect world, be able to have.
And so our job as people, I guess, or our challenge is to find ways to reclaim those rituals, however we can, that allow us to cope with this. And, mm-hmm. and I don't know the answers to that. We're going to try to help our friend in whatever way we can. You know, her sons went over and stood outside her house and talked through her window to her yesterday. So her sons were able to be there for her. And, you know, our ongoing challenge is how do you cope with the loss and the rituals like you're talking about? I mean, having a baby is like the most important, one of the most fundamental primal experiences. And I guess the challenge is to find a way to make that, to reclaim what you're losing in the old way that it used to be done.
And we just, if you were sort of keeping time with us in the episode, Kara Thrace's Viper just exploded.
Which led to a very strange thing. And when we were trying to keep this all quiet and to let people not know that, you know, that she was really dead, her credit didn't appear on the next episode. I wasn't up there for the drama that happened when nobody had told the rest of the cast that she was coming.
Yeah,
back.
It was, I'll just comment on the scene first. I'm just struck by the looks on everyone's faces. Yes. Like it's just, there's no sound. It's just every single person is just stunned because Starbuck is always the one that she always makes it out. And like nobody says anything, nobody breaks down. No, it's just, disbelief and on set we all were we held a goodbye ceremony for her, not ceremony, but you know, where you all stand in the CIC and cry and hug and we'll stay in touch and all that kind of stuff. Everybody was like bawling, and Eddie was not to jump ahead, but I think everybody knows Starbuck comes back, but
spoiler.
Everybody, Eddie was mad. Everybody was mad when, you know, that we were, well, we felt lied to because we're like, if you can't trust us, but it was definitely a well-kept secret. And I gotta ask, is this a scene? Because I know Eddie, that he destroys the ship, the model ship.
Yes.
That was not scripted, yes. Correct? I've heard the story many times. It was not scripted. And that was a very expensive on loan ship from a museum. And he just impromptu smashes it to pieces.
Well, he kind of told, he did tell Nankin that this was coming so that they could cover it. But Michael was, and the camera guys were the only ones that knew that that's what he was going to do.
Was it an expensive?
Yes.
Nankin knew this and Nankin allowed it?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not just
another tense moment for Harvey Friend when he found out. I think it was worth like $40,000 or something like that. Maybe, I don't know.
The number keeps going up every time I hear it. I like
it. I've heard numbers of like 750,000 and stuff. So, okay, 40 is a lot of money, but.
And then to Harvey's credit, what a great line producer. He realized the value of it, and he didn't hold a grudge or get mad after the stunning moment. And I remember when he did it, I remember almost walking by and go, watch his next take. Gonna do something a little interesting. No, he's good.
I was there for that. And that.
After it was over, Brad, usually I'm the emotional guy who's spilling tears and everything, and Brad totally lost it at the end of that scene. He was, I remember that.
That's true.
It was beautiful. I mean, I can't think of the scene now. Imagine the scene without that, actually, right?
Yeah, it was not scripted, nothing. We had it was just supposed to end with them putting that, Aurora thing on the head of the ship. That was the scripted version of the end of it. So.
I remember reading the script last night, and yeah, it doesn't mention anything about a ship blowing up.
being knocked to smithereens.
Property damage wins.
Well, two ships blow up. The one you rode in, Katie's ship blowing up, and then the model ship being torn to pieces, yes.
Whoops.
Yeah, the answer at the last scene, 72A, is Adama carefully affixes the delicate figurine to the prow of his model ship, gazes at it, says, a fair wind and the morning star. And then the text line after that is, suddenly it's all too much. His tears come in a flood, fade out. There's no destruction of model ship at this point.
Since we've already spoiled that Starbuck is not permanently absent from the show.
What?
What? I know.
Where did you hear that?
Did you guys know at this point that you were going to be bringing her back? Did you know when you're going to be bringing her back? Was that all?
No. We didn't know how. We didn't know what the situation would be that would produce it, or what excuse we would use for it happening, or it was a mystery. We just knew that this was not the end of her. Did we know that we were going to find her? And again, this is all spoilers, that she was going to find herself.
None of that had happened yet, but I believe what happened, what Ram wrote the last episode, as he always did, of this season. And I think we, as a writing staff, found out at the same time we're reading the script, and all of a sudden, Karen pulls up next to Lee in her Viper and goes, I've been to Earth. I know where it is. those kind of things would just appear in Ron's scripts, and the rest of the writing staff would be like, what? I mean, we knew she was coming back, but like, we didn't know she was coming back that way.
So, did Katie know she was coming back?
Yes. That was the agony when she lied to everybody on, this was our brilliant, stupid plan. Tell all the rest of the cast that you got a better offer, you're going to another show. And people were getting pissed, like, how dare you don't care about the show anymore, you're leaving. And then Katie finally contacted Ron, I think, and said, help. this is getting out of control here. And then we realized it was like a stupid idea not to tell the cast. We were all just scared of the internet planning out. Of course, they always find out anyway, so no matter what you do.
Yeah, imagine doing it now at this,
yeah,
it'd be impossible now. Back then, there was a
shot. Yeah.
Yeah.
You could hope to keep a secret.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow, that was emotionally draining. I forgot how emotionally draining an episode this was.
I feel so honored to have been part of it. So honored that we got to do it.
It's fantastic stuff. Trisha, do you have a frack down for this episode?
There's so many, but there's one. I guess the scene, it just keeps popping in my head, so that's what I'm gonna say. The scene where she's in the, her and Cara and Lee are in the corridor staring at the wall of pictures. Mm-hmm. And, you know, especially, and you reminded me, David, of bringing it back from when Kat dies and Kara's almost sort of making fun of her for, you know, wanting to be up there somewhere, that the scene between her and Lee of where their picture would want to be placed. And it just struck me at the time of there's just the two of them there talking. And if one of them dies, they will put that picture up where they want it. But it struck me of the other, when the next person dies, that won't, that little bond, that little agreement between them can never be fulfilled.
Right.
And it just, it I don't know why, but that just particularly struck
me. And you know, we're going to pay that, we're going to revisit that wall next episode.
I will watch that later.
I will do my homework.
Unless it's one episode later, but I believe it's the very next episode.
So Mark, what was your frack down?
My frack down was, what do you hear? Nothing but the rain. And grab your cat and grab your gun and bring in the cat. You know, that's the if I remember correctly, the first line of dialogue that Eddie
right.
And Katie have. And so now for this to be their last exchange,
right.
To circle it all the way back. Like this episode is very much about bringing her story full circle. And to be able to do that in dialogue, to be able to do that thematically and verbally, I just found incredibly touching. And incredibly harmonic. It's harmonizing with itself in a way that many shows don't get to do because they just don't get to have that perspective. They don't get to have a plan that you can widely deviate from. But once you have, you know, three seasons of TV, you know where the treasure lies. And so to be able to go back and cherry pick and make that thing emotionally resonant in a way that it wasn't before, I just found very, very touching. And that's what I remembered. Oh man, are they gonna kill? They're doing all, they're gonna kill her this episode.
Never watch TV with a professional.
Yeah, no. Exactly. You see everything coming.
All right, guys. Do you guys want David, do you have a frack down? Can you choose one?
I don't know what you mean exactly.
Frack down is something in the episode that either stands out to you in a good way, in a bad way. Since you guys wrote it, it's something maybe that you remember, something that, you know, irked you. Usually they're good, but fans tweet to us what their frack down was. One, a couple of episodes was Leoben. They noticed the door when he has her locked, and then it's a flashback to her being on New Caprica. And they zero in on the door, and the door is actually not locked. The deadbolt.
I would say the teaser, which was Ron Moore's idea. He came up with the idea of that dream, and that she's making love to Leoben and looking up, and the mandala bleeds through the white paint. And as I was watching it again, I thought one of my favorite novels, which is Under the Volcano, which is this metaphysical novel in a lot of ways. And the protagonist keeps echoing this line in his head, how alike are the sounds of love and the sounds of dying. And so that you have this act of this sex act, which is procreation. And she's looking up and the mandala bleeds through. In a lot of ways, all of the emotional elements are right there in that teaser. And it was such a brilliant idea that Ron came up with, and in a way Nick can execute it. There's something so weirdly haunting and powerful when that mandala bleeds through the pain and she's looking at it over the open shoulder at it. I love that scene.
Mm. Well, I guess this is up to me, and I don't actually have it as a scene. The moment for me of this particular episode was the moment when Harvey Fran came in and rolled the hard six.
that's great. Yes. Yeah.
Perfect. I like those frack downs.
Outstanding. So you guys still in the trenches on For All Mankind?
No, we're homebound. Wanting longing to return to war because it's all I know. I don't, I'm not fit for this. I'm not fit for real life. I need to get back in the trenches. I need to go back. Well, my unit's waiting for me.
I just got a VisiFX request for all of what are the numbers that are supposed to be on the heads up display inside a T-38 jet from VisiFX. So it's still moving ahead, even slowly, and we're looking forward to getting back to it if and when that ever happens. And what's going to be weird for me is when we start seeing these shows later is what does America look like now? Because already looking at the screen, I'm looking at those guys are too close to one another, you know, and how will you ever be able to do period pictures again if this thing hangs around?
Yeah, no. I mean, it's funny watching TV and every commercial is mocking me. Like, oh, look at all these people at a restaurant and who were on vacation in a park. Like, stop it. You're too close together.
And when we shut down, literally, we were headed into the preliminaries of a love scene. And I was just thinking, you know, it's like actors, I got to get close. And will we be able to do that again?
I literally, my last dance, I came back from Slovakia and I was filming Van Helsing over there. And then, and I will admit biting people and all that kind of thing as Dracula does. But I came back and I did an episode of a show that I'm not allowed to say, but that was my last day on set before the shutdown. And it was you talk about page length, that was a seven page scene between four people. And the entire day was me kissing one of the people and hugging and hands all over the other two people. And I've thought about that. Like, how would we shoot that scene coming back? Maybe in the future, you know, once things have got to whatever new normal it is, will we ever get back to that? Will we ever see?
Well, I tell you, you know, in very many ways, the adult film industry is at the forefront of entertainment technology, and they figured out a way to deal with this with people having to be physically in close proximity. They just test before every time they shoot.
Well, that's what I'm hearing already is that they're hoping to be able to expand the testing protocol, and that will enable people to start to go back to work. You'll have to get tested. And I mean,
yeah, I mean,
I don't know. I will say
a test that works within hours, that would be great. But and literally every set I've been on has been a petri dish of everybody getting the flu. Everybody gets everything.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, I think either South Korea or somebody has the blood test, which you can tell in you know, half an hour. And so if it's a finger prick, like you're getting a diabetes, a blood sugar test, and they can tell that you're clear. All right, go in there, kiss that person.
I like that fantasy. I'm gonna, or theory. I mean, not that day we come up with a test like that, and I'm hoping that will be true.
Well, we are in the business of fantasy.
Well, it's a fantasy, but you know, it could happen. I'm not. I didn't mean to say that like I was discrediting the idea. I very much hope that that's true. Mm. We just don't know yet, but I hope that that's true.
Indeed.
Yes.
Well, gentlemen, as always, thank you so much for taking time out of your days to join us and talk about Maelstrom, talk about Battlestar.
Thank you for letting us participate. It was a thrill.
It was an honor to work on it, and it's great to be able to see you guys again.
Yay.
Okay, take care.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, guys.
As always, we would like to thank the great and mighty Brett Boehm for doing the fanciest audio wizardry. Thanks to Bear McCreary for our theme song, to Sci-Fi Wire, for whom we forgot to take a commercial pause in the middle, and so we apologize.
We did. It was too interesting.
It was too much. All happening. Too much. And as always, thank you to Tricia Helfer for continuing to grace us with her presence and her cats.
Oh, well, thank you, Mark. I appreciate it. You're always very kind. I even have cats on my pen. Look at.
Yeah, you do.
Anyway, thank you guys.
And we will see you guys next week for The Sun Also Rises.
With another guest.
We got guests up the wazoo. And I love it.
Yes.
So stay safe, everybody. Wash your hands. wear a mask. Don't go outside.
Stay safe.
Yes. So say we all.